This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on July 2nd. The Washington, D.C. publication The Hill recently identified 7 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court as most anticipated. They encompass Donald Trump's tax records, LGBT workplace protections, deportation protections for undocumented immigrants, that is the DACA program, Louisiana's abortion law, faithless electors, that is, electoral college members with a mind of their own, religious exemptions from discrimination suits, birth control and insurance, and public funding of private education, and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Nevertheless, there have been several consequential cases that have been decided through a separate process that essentially bypasses proceedings that would normally entail arguments and deliberation. An op-ed in the New York Times on June 17th points out that this has been accomplished repeatedly by the Trump administration, seeking stays of lower court losses. Before Trump, such emergency stays were utilized rarely. However, during the past 3 years, the Justice Department has sought 29 of them from the Supreme Court, and the author observes that the justices have generally acquiesced, quote, granting 17 of the applications in full or in part, rulings that have had significant and lasting ramifications on the ground, and that have often been quite divisive on the court, unquote. For example, emergency stays enabled the 2017 travel ban, diversion of military construction funds to help build the border wall, and the Remain in Mexico and public charge rules that stymie asylum seekers. The purpose of such stays is to preserve the status quo while cases work their way through the system. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has not had the opportunity to rule on the merits of these cases, and may never be able to do so. The author points out, instead, emergency relief from the court has become a de facto vindication of these programs, allowing them to continue to operate, perhaps for the entire Trump presidency, even though lower courts have held them invalid, and despite no final determination by the justices that those lower courts were wrong. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Stephen Vladeck, the A. Dalton Cross Professor at the University of Texas School of Law. He is a nationally recognized expert on the federal courts, constitutional law, national security law, and military justice. Steve has argued cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, and he is the author of the opinion piece that I just referenced. We also have our regular guest, Jim Harrington, founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project, and my co-op colleague, Michelle Manning Scott, is here as well. Thanks for joining us, Steve. How are you and your family holding up through the pandemic?
It's great to be with you, Bob. Thanks for having me. It's, you know, I think we're doing as well as can be expected. My wife and I are both very, very lucky. We have jobs that have allowed us to try to balance, you know, the demands on our time with getting our work done. every day is a new adventure, but we're better off than a lot of other people are. We thank our blessings for that.
Well, in addition to the pandemic and all the protests and social upheaval, we've had a pretty incredible session with the U.S. Supreme Court, and that's what we're going to talk about here this evening. You know, I've been through all the cases, and there's just so much, but I want to start off with a few that I think are really big, and one being the LGBT workplace protections. There were actually three different cases here, right?
Yeah, so there are three different cases. Two of them were about whether when Title VII, the federal employment discrimination statute, refers to discrimination on the basis of sex, whether that also includes discrimination based upon an employee's sexual orientation. And there's a third case about whether that includes discrimination based upon an employee's transgender status. And, you know, the court, by a 6-3 vote, said yes to all three, that, you know, for purposes of Title VII at least, sex-based discrimination includes sexual orientation and transgender-based discrimination, a pretty significant ruling in the court's, I think, increasing pantheon of LGBT rights decisions. This really ranks up there.
Yeah. I was saying to some friends, I think this is bigger than the marriage decision, you know, I think because it touches everybody. And who'd have thunk that 1964 Civil Rights Act had the key in there, at least, you know, by today's interpretation. And
well, and Bob, I think it's two different things. I mean, I think one, some of the modern conservative justices, especially Neil Gorsuch, really hold themselves out to be textualists, meaning that, you know, they think a statute has to be written the way that its terms are understood, even if it doesn't make sense, even if it's not what Congress might have intended.
Right.
But, you know, to your first point, Bob, I share your view that this is perhaps an even more practically significant ruling than the gay marriage decision from 5 years ago for two reasons. One, right, first, yes, it affects everybody, whereas that ruling was principally about those in states that did not already allow marriage between same-sex partners. But two, I mean, I think this is not just going to have a transformational shift on employer attitudes in the workplace, but the idea that, you know, a reference to sex-based discrimination encompasses sexual orientation and transgender status is hardly limited to the workplace, right? That, you know, we could see this decision now being expanded into the context of Title IX when it comes to funding for athletic activities, Title VI when it comes to educational opportunity, and even perhaps the Constitution, where equal protection clauses ban, as the Supreme Court has read it, on sex-based discrimination absent an important governmental interest, right? If we apply that now to LGBT discrimination as well, that could have an enormous effect far and wide, you know, afield of just employment discrimination, the likes of which the court was considering in these cases.
And yet there are probably any number of unanswered questions, it seems to me. You know, there have been so many different religious exemptions that have been filed in recent years. And does this actually settle all of those? Or, you know, what about a church that doesn't want to have a gay minister, for example?
So the court went out of its way to not answer that question. And actually, I mean, we're at a bit of a disadvantage since we're recording this on Thursday and it's airing on Tuesday night. It's possible that by Tuesday night, one of the cases the court will have decided between when we recorded and when this is airing is a case actually about something called the ministerial exception to Title VII, when federal employment discrimination law does or doesn't apply to those who work for churches or religious schools or the like. So, you know, I think, Bob, there's definitely a lot left to be decided about the intersection between religion and this kind of discrimination. Those cases, I think, will work themselves out over the next couple of years. But even if the court, as I suspect it will, finds at least some religious exemptions to this ruling, that's still a much, I think, more positive development to my view than a holding that, you know, categorically, LGBT discrimination is not sex-based discrimination for purposes of Title VII. And, you know, I'm not shocked that Justice Neil Gorsuch, who wrote the majority opinion, was willing to adopt such a result. I'm pretty surprised by the sixth vote. I'm pretty surprised that he brought Chief Justice John Roberts with him. I mean, it was the first time in his career that Roberts has ever voted in favor of plaintiffs in an LGBT discrimination case. So, you know, my hope is that that's a bellwether of where the court's going to be on these kinds of discrimination questions going forward. But you're absolutely right that the religious exemptions are going to be a big part of the story, and those remain to be fleshed out.
Well, all I can think is that Anton Scalia is probably flipping in his grave right now.
I think there are a lot of ways in which this court does not necessarily look like the court Scalia left involuntarily 4.5 years ago.
Let's move on to the DACA case. It seems to me that this was decided a little more on procedure. It's definitely not settled yet. Do I have that right?
This is very much like one of the big cases from last year when the Supreme Court, by the same 5-4 majority with the Chief Justice joining the more progressive justices, basically held that the government couldn't ask a citizenship question on the 2020 census, not because it lacked the power to do it, but because the way it had proposed to do it violated something called the Administrative Procedure Act. In many respects, the DACA decision is a rerun of that, where the court didn't say anything about whether DACA itself is lawful as a program. The court, I think, in various places made it pretty clear that it believes that the Trump administration has the power to rescind DACA as long as it does so the right way. But the problem that, you know, Chief Justice Roberts found is that the administration didn't do it the right way, that, as he put it, it didn't turn square corners because it rescinded the program based upon an explanation that just wasn't remotely plausible. Right. And that, you know, it's that we have to be careful to differentiate between, can the government take an action in the abstract and can the government act in a particular manner based on the claims it's making? You know, I think the real lesson of the DACA case is probably not the short-term win for DACA program participants, but rather, you know, the broader pattern it reinforces, where the Trump administration has lost a ton of these administrative law cases in the Supreme Court and the lower courts, simply because it hasn't dotted its I's and crossed its T's. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's not shocking that someone like John Roberts, who is a very, I think, old school conservative technocrat, would gravitate toward those kinds of defects rather than going fully up or down on DACA.
Jim, you've been working with immigrants and farm workers so many years. What's your take on this case?
Well, obviously it's really important. DACA is really important. I mean, this is a group of people that has brought into the country. These kids were brought into the country, and they're now gainfully employed as teachers and lawyers and, you know, just good and decent people. Obviously, it's going to have, would have a big effect on the families that all of a sudden they were found themselves to be deported. There's all more reason, I think, that we have to look at what's going to happen in the presidential election.
That's what occurred to me, at least before the decision, was had they decided in favor of Department of Homeland Security, I mean, the social upheaval in this country, and who knows, that could still happen. As you say, Steve, this is far from resolved at this point.
There was no way that the court was going to avoid a politically fraught decision here. And I think, you know, the politics of this are such that it's going to be pretty difficult, not legally, but politically, for the Trump administration to rescind DACA the right way between now and the election, mm-hmm. but not at all if the president wins. And so, you know, I think in that respect, one of the many things the election now becomes a referendum on is DACA, because I think, you know, the Trump administration would gladly rescind it in a second term. And I don't think we have to speculate that a Biden administration would not. And I think a lot of the court's big decisions this term are very much with that looming omnipresence, knowing that what it's doing might be a short-term thing, depending upon what happens in November. It's not clear to me how that plays out politically. I mean, I think one of the areas where the president actually might have more support beyond his, you know, very core dedicated base is in his aggressive, hostile immigration policies. But on the flip side, preserving DACA might also be something that gets a lot of folks who might not otherwise have turned out to the polls to want to vote in November. So I think it's clearly an electoral issue. It's just not clear to me which way that cuts.
You know, back to your recent Times op-ed about the stays and the bypassing of normal procedures in the courts, is there any way that this could work its way into one of those stays, do you think? I mean, you know, certainly the travel ban was in that category 3 years ago.
Sure. I mean, I think if we do see an effort by the administration, you know, to rescind DACA before the election, I think there will be efforts to block it and a lot of pressure on the Supreme Court to put any such lower court decision on hold through a stay. I just, you know, Bob, again, I don't know that the politics makes sense. If I'm President Trump, I'd rather have the issue than the result in November. And so I think, you know, it's much more likely that DACA stays unaffected for the next 4 months. And then we wake up, you know, after the election is resolved and figure out what happens next.
Okay. Well, speaking of procedural cases, then there's this Louisiana abortion case, which sure looked an awful lot like that Texas case 4 years ago. I mean, was it substantially different?
The federal appeals court, the Fifth Circuit, you know, tried very hard to convince folks that this was a different case. But, you know, 4 years ago, the Supreme Court, by a 5-3 majority, struck down a pair of Texas restrictions, one on requiring any facility performing abortions to be an ambulatory surgical center, one that required any doctors performing abortions to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. And Louisiana basically did the same thing. The only thing, Bob, that I think really changed between the Texas case and the Louisiana case was the composition of the Supreme Court. I mean, the 5-3 majority 4 years ago included Justice Anthony Kennedy, and he's not there anymore. I had always thought the Fifth Circuit decision was a rather cynical ruling that was not really about factual differences between Louisiana and Texas, but rather just a ploy to force the Supreme Court to have to reconsider this case now that Justice Kavanaugh has replaced Justice Kennedy. And I think that's where Chief Justice Roberts was. I mean, the decision was a fractured one with a no majority opinion, but Chief Justice Roberts was the decisive vote. He joined with the lefties to strike down the Louisiana law. And as he said, you know, the reason why he was doing it wasn't because he agreed with the decision 4 years ago. He was one of the dissenters.
Yeah.
But because, you know, he thought that that decision answered the question and that, you know, it was the court's job to stand by that decision as opposed to overruling it. And, you know, I think this is an example that we might see again in some of the last cases we get this term, perhaps even by the time this airs. The Chief Justice's institutional sensibilities, perhaps overriding his conservative political philosophy and his interpretive commitments, because, you know, I think he sees his job not just as one of the nine justices, but as the Chief Justice and increasingly as the swing justice. Hmm. You know, I think he's the one who is most thinking about what it looks like to the public and to the court of history, you know, that the Supreme Court might have so quickly overruled a decision for no other reason than a change in its membership. I think that's a big part of why he voted the way he did.
Well, my sense is that this is not the end of abortion cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that a fair assessment?
To the contrary, I think, you know, the best way to understand the ruling in the June medical case, you know, I think this was a false start on abortion jurisprudence after Anthony Kennedy. That I think, you know, the sort of abortion critics, you know, pro-life groups were looking for any vehicle to get the Supreme Court to talk about abortion with, you know, a new solid majority. And they picked perhaps the worst possible one, asking the court to just completely ignore a decision it handed down 4 years ago is not where I would have started. But there are so many other efforts out there in, you know, states like Texas and Arkansas and Mississippi to otherwise restrict access to abortions. I think it's just a matter of time before we get a case where the Chief Justice is not nearly as offended institutionally, and where I think the new solid conservative majority actually will have no trouble exerting itself, not necessarily to overrule Roe versus Wade and Casey, the 1992 case that clarified it, but certainly to narrow them and to give states ever more room if they want them to restrict women's access to pre-viability abortions.
So there's this whole class of what are called trap laws, targeted restrictions on abortion providers that superficially appear to make abortion safer, but they do little to advance patient safety. And, you know, in effect, they make it difficult to operate an abortion clinic. Do you think we're going to see more of those? And you think the challenge to Roe versus Wade would actually be in the form of one of these trap laws?
I don't think so, because the trap laws, as you say, Bob, it's about going after the providers.
Yeah.
And as much as those laws can restrict access to abortions, they're not actually prohibiting the abortions themselves. And so I think, you know, first of all, trap laws are going to have trouble under the Whole Woman's Health case, the 2016 Texas case, and the Chief Justice's concurrence in the Louisiana case from last week. But second, I mean, Bob, I think the place where we're much more likely to see a frontal assault on Roe are state laws that actually categorically take abortions off the table after a certain number of weeks. So, you know, I think it's Mississippi has a fetal heartbeat law that bans abortions as soon as a fetal heartbeat can be detected through a transvaginal ultrasound. And in some cases, that's as early as 6 weeks, which, you know, for many women is before they even know they're pregnant. And so that law could have the effect of, you know, making it impossible for any woman to obtain an abortion under any circumstance. That's the kind of case that I think is much more of a referendum on Roe. And that's where I think the Chief Justice, I don't think he'll be bound by anything he said, concurring opinion in the Louisiana case, because that would be on an issue the court hasn't just decided. And I think that would be an opportunity for the court to, you know, much more directly confront just how much of Roe it's willing to preserve.
Steve, I want to ask you, talking about Roberts. So it seems to me, and I actually hear this from other people, that he's going to be really concerned about his legacy as Chief Justice, and also about preserving institutional integrity of the court system vis-a-vis executive power. And I just kind of wonder what your take is on those observations.
I mean, Jim, I think I agree with both of them. I mean, I think, you know, Dahlia Lithwick had a really, really good column in Slate that I commend folks to read about, you know, how to understand the Chief Justice. I wouldn't disagree with the bottom line, Jim, of either of those points. I might frame them slightly differently, which is that I think the Chief is playing a much longer game than the four other conservative justices, where, you know, I think the four other conservatives seem ready to make all of these pretty dramatic shifts in American jurisprudence overnight. And I think the Chief is, both because of his institutional concerns, Jim, but also because of his own just personality, a bit more of a slow mover and prefers, you know, more longer term gradual shifts in doctrine, both because I think he thinks they're less disruptive in the abstract and because I think he thinks they're less harmful institutionally. And, you know, so the same Chief Justice who joins Neil Gorsuch in the majority in the DACA case and writes this concurring opinion in the Louisiana abortion case, writes the majority opinion in a very, very conservative separation of powers decision about the Consumer Financial Protection Board, you know, joins Justice Alito's very, very conservative opinion in this important case about access to the courts for undocumented immigrants who are subject to expedited removal. And, you know, I don't think there's a contradiction there. I think those are cases where the Chief believes that there's no institutional harm in embracing the conservative position now versus context where I think he views, you know, the sort of the court's role in our system as much more implicated by a decision that breaks on party and political lines. And I should say, I mean, we haven't seen yet what I think are the two biggest cases this term as a test on which Chief Justice shows up. I mean, I think the Trump tax cases, which may have come out by the time this airs, but which we haven't seen at the time we're recording, you know, where he ends up in those cases, especially if the court's 5-4, I think is going to be a far more significant verdict on, you know, how we understand the Chief Justice than anything that's come to pass thus far. But if I can say, Jim, I mean, I think the point on which I think we all agree is it is now abundantly clear, if it wasn't already, that this is the Chief Justice's court, and that in these high profile, divisive, you know, partisan ideological cases, the most likely way that the court goes, you know, in favor of the progressive result is with the Chief Justice switching sides as opposed to any of the other conservatives.
Well, speaking of significant cases, we referenced earlier religious exemptions. By my take, there were actually three different classes there. There was this ministerial exceptions. There was the healthcare coverage, you know, with birth control, the Little Sisters of the Poor. But then there was a third case. You know, those first two we do not have a decision on. But the third case, we just got a decision on Tuesday, and that's the Montana case regarding public funds for private education. This seems to me to be massive. Could you tell us a little about the case?
Yeah, I mean, it's massive, Bob, and it's the Chief Justice. So, you know, to Jim's point, I mean, I think here we are again, you know, where as the Chief goes, so goes the court. So the issue in Espinoza, it's a little complicated, but the sort of the simplest way to distill it is when a state like Montana has a tax credit program that is available to all schools, including private schools, is it unconstitutional for Montana to say, but it's not available to religious schools because we are worried about spending money on religious schools. And this is the age-old problem with the two great religious clauses in the Constitution, right? The First Amendment has both the Free Exercise Clause, which says the government can't interfere with our free exercise of religion, and it has the Establishment Clause, which says the government can't prefer religion. And so there's this remarkable sort of space between the two, where states are trying to figure out how to not establish religion in a way that doesn't discriminate against religion. That's what Espinoza is about. So what's really significant about Espinoza is that in prior cases, the Supreme Court had suggested that there was a gray area, that there was some space between conduct that the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause both prohibit, and that states had some discretion in that gray area. And so Montana says, you know, we're not sure if it would violate the Establishment Clause to include religious schools in this program, but just to be safe, we're not going to do it. And the Chief Justice says, no. He says, unless it actually would violate the Establishment Clause, you can't single out religious schools without violating the Free Exercise Clause. In other words, he shrinks the gray area. And, you know, that's a very big deal, Bob, in two respects. One, it calls into question a whole bunch of these so-called Blaine amendments, state constitutional amendments from the early 20th century that, you know, I think there's some debate as to their origins, but that had the idea of prohibiting state spending on religious education. And now I think those are all vulnerable because of Espinoza. But two, I mean, we saw in the concurring opinions that the court now with its new majority, as opposed to when Anthony Kennedy was still the swing vote, is really ready to revisit some of the court's older fundamental religion precedents. And there's already a huge case on the docket for next term called, I think, Fulton versus City of Philadelphia, where one of the questions is whether the court should overrule a 1990 decision called Employment Division versus Smith. That case was an enormously significant ruling that says it does not violate the Free Exercise Clause when governments have neutral laws of general applicability that just happen to incidentally burden religion. So subjecting a church to a zoning ordinance, right, is fine under Smith. Well, if we revisit Smith, all of a sudden, you know, that blows the door open for all kinds of religious exemptions to even ordinary neutral government laws like fire codes. Espinoza is not that case, Bob, but I think Espinoza is a harbinger of what we're going to see, you know, when Fulton gets argued in October or November of this year.
We're speaking with Steve Vladeck about recent decisions from the United States Supreme Court. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on July 2nd. We're speaking with Steve Vladeck about recent decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's continue.
Another case that I want to get your thoughts on, particularly in light of the unrest in the country and Black Lives Matter, was the refusal of the court to visit qualified immunity, which, as you know, is a major hurdle or block for civil rights litigation.
Yeah, I mean, Jim, I wasn't that surprised. I mean, even before the chaotic and tragic events of the summer, there had been a push from civil rights and civil liberties and libertarian groups to get the Supreme Court to revisit this entirely judge-made doctrine under which law enforcement officers can't be held liable for violating the Constitution unless the violation was clearly established. That is to say, unless there was no doubt, in essence, that the officer had acted in a way that was unconstitutional at the time he acted. The court had already passed on a series of cases asking them to revisit that doctrine in the last 4 or 5 years. So I'm not surprised they did it again. I think, you know, this is a good example of the court believing that there are circumstances where the right avenue for reform is Congress, even for doctrines that are the court's fault. And that's why, you know, I think I wasn't surprised, Jim, that the only justice who dissented from the denials of the qualified immunity cases was Justice Thomas. He's never shy about what he thinks the court should be doing. But, you know, I think this is a good example of something that has broken down in our system. You know, in the old days, I think it was much more common for the court to be in this dialogue with Congress where, you know, the Congress would routinely react and respond. to judicial decisions, or as in this case, non-decisions, by taking the mantle. And that hasn't been true for the last decade or so. I mean, there's only really one very visible example in the last, 15 years of Congress taking up an invitation from the Supreme Court. That was the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. And I think that's unfortunate, because I think part of the way the system works best is where the court can sort of tee things up for the legislature, and the legislature then changes the law. You know, I think, Jim, this is, to my mind, an unfortunate but predictable consequence of the court's small c conservatism, that, you know, all of the justices are not necessarily inclined to lead the charge in circumstances where it looks like there are other actors who could.
Well, speaking of refusal to hear cases, tell us a little about this vote by mail case for Texas. Was it Justice Alito refused to hear the case? Could you fill us in about that?
Yeah, so there have been two sort of parallel lawsuits in Texas that have been trying to attack the limitation in Texas law on when folks can vote by mail. So Texas allows folks to request a vote by mail, an absentee ballot, or whatever you want to call it, if they're over the age of 65 or if they are disabled. And so the fighting has been over whether fear of contracting coronavirus counts as a disability, such that, you know, folks who don't want to go to crowded, jam-packed polling places simply to exercise their right to vote can, you know, vote by mail to avoid that specter. And both the Texas Supreme Court and the Fifth Circuit have thus far said no. What's interesting about the way that the federal case is framed is it's not trying to challenge the interpretation of disability under Texas law. It's actually arguing that Texas law is unconstitutional under the 26th Amendment. And, you know, just in case we haven't memorized our constitutions, that's the one that says the right to vote cannot be denied to anyone over the age of 18 on account of their age. And so the argument is that the sort of the 65 and over provision is unconstitutional insofar as it, you know, creates a categorical right to vote by mail for the elderly, but not for younger people. That's actually a pretty interesting argument. It's a question the courts have not really grappled with that carefully over the years. The problem is that, you know, because it's a question of first impression, it's hard to see how that gets decided by the election. And so the first thing that happened was the district court issued an injunction. The Fifth Circuit overturned the injunction, or at least stayed the injunction pending disposition of the appeal. And the challengers, the Texas Democratic Party, asked the Supreme Court to lift the Fifth Circuit stay, and the Supreme Court refused. And then on Thursday, the day we recorded this, the court also denied the Texas Democrats' request to expedite consideration of their cert petition. That is to say, the court said, we're not going to hurry to decide your appeal on the merits. And, you know, what that means is that practically there's just no way this is going to be resolved before the election. And so I think the status quo where, you know, folks who are under the age of 65 can't vote by mail unless they can show some specific disability is unfortunately going to be where we end up. And I think that's, you know, a pretty jarring place to be from the perspective of forcing folks to choose between, you know, the risk of catching a highly contagious virus and exercising the right to vote.
You know, I've got so many things on the table here, but we have to work in this one case, and that is Hernandez versus Mesa. And who would be in a better position to tell us about that than yourself?
So this is a case that I argued in November, actually right after the DACA case. And as I think some folks know, this is a case arising out of a cross-border shooting, actually, where the Border Patrol agent was in Texas, where he was standing on U.S. soil just outside of El Paso. And he fires across the border and kills an unarmed 15-year-old Mexican national, Sergio Hernandez. And the question was, if we assume, without deciding, if we just assume for the sake of this case, that Mesa acted unconstitutionally, that the agent used excessive force, that he didn't have a good justification, that he violated Sergio's constitutional rights, are Sergio's parents entitled to a remedy? Are they entitled to sue Agent Mesa for damages? And back in February, for a 5-4 court, the Supreme Court said no. You know, as part of this long line of cases where the court has been increasingly hostile to the idea of judge-made remedies, Justice Alito says, you know, we don't think we should recognize a damages remedy in cases that touch on these kinds of foreign relations and national security concerns. And, you know, I think that folks might agree in the abstract that, you know, the court shouldn't be in a hurry to jump into foreign relations and national security cases. I guess I'm just not necessarily convinced that an alleged use of excessive force by a single Border Patrol officer is that kind of case that, you know, sort of implicates the national security and foreign relations policy of the United States, as opposed to, you know, trying to ensure deterrence for individual officers who go off the reservation. But, you know, as you know, Bob, I'm a little biased on this one.
Well, that was your second case before the Supreme Court, right?
Actually, I was supposed to have a third. I was set to argue a case on Monday, March 23rd, the very first case that actually got postponed by the pandemic. And now it's been kicked to October. So I get to go back in October, either personally or as I suspect, over the phone, if they're still not sitting in person.
Thinking about just a couple other cases that are pending yet, you mentioned the president's tax records and finances. Any sense about where that's going to go or what that means?
Well, I mean, I think they're both going to be close. You know, I'm not surprised they're taking this long. I mean, you know, further to our last, the pandemic forced the court to basically cancel its March and April sittings. And so it had this, you know, very unusual May session where it heard half of the cases it had postponed. You know, a big part of why the court's now going into July, and indeed going past July 4th for the first time since 1986, is because it heard these cases that late. And, you know, 2 months is about as fast as the court ever moves from argument to decision. I don't have a great prediction. There are two very different cases. There's the case about Congress's subpoenas. Bob, my best bet there, and it's possible by the time this airs, you know, we'll see if I'm right. My best bet there is that the court's going to split the difference and that there's going to be at least five justices who are willing to sustain at least one, maybe two of the subpoenas, but who also want to put some teeth into the separation of powers by, you know, also imposing limits on Congress. And so maybe uphold a couple subpoenas and strike down a couple subpoenas. That may sound like a mixed bag, but I actually think that would be a huge loss for the president if that happens. And then there's the very different New York case where it's not a congressional subpoena, but rather a criminal subpoena from a local prosecutor, from the district attorney in Manhattan. I think that case is actually, you know, I'd be very surprised the way the argument went if the president won that case. I actually thought it was much clearer from the argument that that case was going to go in favor of the subpoena. Not clear what that means in the short term, since grand jury materials are secret. Like, I don't know that if, you know, Cyrus Vance, the DA, wins that case, all of a sudden we're going to have access to those financial records. But, you know, I do think that the president's likely to lose at least one and maybe one and a half of those cases. Although the reason why I'm a law professor is because my predictions are worth what you paid for them.
Well, speaking of worthless.
Oh, no, just the opposite.
Yeah, exactly. But let's talk about faithless, okay? What about those faithless electors?
There are some cases, and they don't happen often, where I think the court is so worried about the practical consequences of ruling one way that they'll rule the other way just because, and then try to figure out why. And, you know, there's a case that the court might decide by the time this airs about whether like a third of Eastern Oklahoma is actually a Native American reservation that falls into that category where, you know, the law seems to say that the answer is yes. And I think the court very much wants to find a way to say that the answer is no. I feel the same way about the faithless elector cases. So these are two separate cases, one from Colorado and one from Washington. A couple of states have passed laws that basically prohibit presidential electors from voting for anybody other than whoever the state says they should vote for. So, you know, one of the dirty little secrets of the Electoral College is that at least some presidential electors are not technically bound to vote for their state's person. So there have been, I think in 2016, there were a couple of faithless electors who didn't vote the way their state wanted to, which messed up the final electoral vote count. You know, this has been for most of history a quirk. You know, there hasn't yet been a presidential election where faithless electors were the difference. But I think there's a very real concern that in a very close presidential election, you know, having the election swing away from the person who won the requisite number of states to have an electoral college majority, simply because five people we've never met changed their minds. You know, I think there's real concern about that. So the question is whether states are allowed to bind their electors and basically force their electors to vote for whoever the state tells them to. And I have to say, guys, I will be very surprised if the Supreme Court says no. Right? I mean, I think that's not tantamount to saying that all electors have to vote for who their state tells them to, but it's tantamount to saying a state can make them. And, you know, I think the alternative rule where a state couldn't force the electors to vote the way the state told them to is just an invitation for electoral chaos that the Supreme Court, I think, is very much ill-inclined to send.
Yeah. One other case you brought up earlier, and that's this Consumer Protection Board, this thing that Elizabeth Warren championed some years ago. They decided against the board. Is that right? It allows the president to fire the director at will. What's the significance of this one?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is in a different time when we weren't so focused on Trump. This actually, I think, would have been one of the bigger separation of powers cases of the term. One of the great old fights in constitutional law when it comes to this executive power is the battle between the president and Congress over what are called independent agencies in the executive branch. And, you know, from the 1930s onward, the Supreme Court has blessed the idea that you could have at least some modicum of independence in the executive branch. So we have, you know, the SEC, the FTC, the FCC, the Federal Reserve, these entities that are technically in the executive branch, but that are protected from, you know, pure partisan political control by the president, largely through for-cause removal requirements. And the idea is that, you know, the president can't just fire someone because he doesn't like them. He actually has to have a good reason. It's been a huge theme of the, you know, sort of resurgent conservative constitutional law canon that independence in the executive branch is unconstitutional and that it's inconsistent with the so-called unitary executive theory of executive power. The CFPB case is basically sort of a point along the way where, you know, when Congress, spearheaded by Senator Warren, created the CFPB as a way of ensuring more independent accountability for consumer financial protection, when some of the sort of post-Enron, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley reforms didn't work the way they were supposed to, Congress said, we're going to have this independent agency, the CFPB, but instead of having multiple heads, multiple commissioners, like the SEC and the FTC and the FCC, we're going to have a single director. And the single director is going to be protected from removal by the president except for cause. And what the Supreme Court held in the CFPB case is you can't do that. That, you know, whatever else is true about the FCC and the SEC and the FCC, those are all multi-member commissions. And that having a single director who's insulated from removal is taking away too much power from the president. And, you know, I think it's not that big of a case in the abstract, guys, but I think the reason why it matters is because what John Roberts basically wrote in his majority opinion is that these multi-member commissions are the exception and that any effort by Congress to create new exceptions to a unitary executive are inherently suspect. And so when we think about, you know, what a new Democratic Congress might do as early as next January to try to, you know, introduce more checks and balances into the executive branch, to try to, you know, implement some of the lessons we've learned from the Trump administration, this is a warning bell that, you know, Congress is not going to have a lot of room to innovate when it comes to insulating executive branch structures, however independent, from the president. That's, you know, troubling enough in itself. But then there's a separate concurring opinion by, I think, Justices Thomas and Gorsuch that basically say even the multi-member commissions are problematic, where they basically suggest that this really significant 1935 case, Humphrey's Executor, which the Supreme Court decided unanimously, should be overruled. And, you know, we don't really have time to do it justice, but it's not an overstatement to say that Humphrey's Executor is the foundation of our modern administrative state. And a world in which, you know, a conservative majority is attacking those foundations is one that I think, you know, might be fine in the short term because whoever's in charge will just have more power. But I think is in the long term bad in the sense that, you know, it will only increase the power of the executive branch in the abstract. And, you know, some of us might be totally cool with that if that happens while someone we like is in the White House. But I don't think anyone needs to look at recent events and see how that could be a serious problem if that power fell into the wrong hands.
We've only got a few minutes left here. Let's look into the crystal ball here a little bit for next year. I'm already seeing a whole raft of cases, not the least of which is California versus Texas, the Affordable Care Act. Will that be the ultimate word on the ACA?
Maybe. The court is doing this really interesting dance when it comes to the election, which is they're taking up some cases that have pretty significant political valences to them, but doing it in a way where it's possible that the politics will have totally shifted by the time they're decided. So, you know, the ACA case is a huge one. This is an effort by Texas to get the entire Affordable Care Act thrown out. This is, you know, I think the latest in a line of, to my mind, increasingly cynical attacks on that law, but what do I know? I don't think the court's going to be able to decide that case before, certainly before the election, and probably before if Biden wins, or at least certainly if there's a new Congress, before the new Congress comes in. So, you know, I think Texas has an uphill battle to begin with in that case, and that battle may become even more uphill if the court is looking over its shoulder at a, you know, one-party Democratic rule in Washington. But on the flip side of that, I mean, also, you know, just this morning as we're recording, the Supreme Court granted cert in the, you know, Mueller grand jury materials case. And, you know, that's almost the opposite phenomenon, where there the court granted cert and did not expedite, which means that, you know, there's no way that case will be decided before January when a new Congress comes in and that case becomes moot. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it's a little early to try to figure out which will be the most momentous decisions of next term as opposed to the momentous cases. You know, I still think that the Fulton case about the free exercise clause is actually perhaps the real clubhouse leader for constitutional law significance. Mm-hmm. But, you know, keep in mind, guys, I mean, the court hasn't even filled half of its docket yet for next term. And so I think, you know, all we're doing right now is looking at the early returns when it's entirely possible that, you know, we're going to have some major election cases that the court has to deal with in the middle of the fall. You know, we're going to have a whole bunch of pandemic related cases that the court is going to get as things worsen over the course of the summer. And then, you know, if there is a new administration, radical, you know, moves by Congress and or the new president, you know, those challenges, if they hustle, could perhaps get to the court even by the end of next term. So I think it's going to be a really, really big term, but I think it's probably one where the election's going to be the biggest story one way or the other. And how big of a term it is from the decision perspective may depend upon how the election goes.
Jim, did you have something to add in there?
I'm really interested in the separation of powers thing going on. And that's, again, coming back to Roberts and how that will play out with respect to the judiciary. You know, he did something that was unusual in coming out to defend some of the trial judges that were under attack by Trump. My read on that is that he's very sensitive about preserving the role of the judiciary and the separation of powers.
I think he is, Jim. I think that he's sensitive. I think that he might calibrate his sensitivity different than you or I would. And so he's sensitive on his terms. The president coming out and attacking, you know, so-called Obama judges, you know, that was enough to set him off, which I thought was a really interesting moment. You know, I have to say, I mean, I don't think, unlike perhaps some of the other conservative justices, I don't think John Roberts has any love for President Trump. And, you know, I think back to what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, Roberts as someone who has been, you know, part of the conservative legal establishment in Washington since the Reagan administration, who's very good at playing the long game and who has, you know, a ton of historical perspective. I think he also may be of the view that in the long term, Trump is actually really bad for conservative legal principles because of the counter reaction he's already engendered and may yet engender going forward. And so, you know, I don't know if the chief will vote in November, and I certainly don't know how he's going to vote, but I could imagine a world where he'd actually not shed any tears if the election did not come out favorably for the incumbent. Not because he doesn't support many of these policies, but because, you know, for his bigger, longer term project, he needs an independent court, or at least a court that's perceived as independent. And he needs a world in which, you know, it's not perceived as a naked power grab every time the court, you know, sides with conservatives in one of these hot button disputes. And, you know, for better or for worse, Trump has, I think, raised the political profile of the court in ways that I think are antithetical to that mission.
Well, Steve, we went through a lot of really big cases here. Did I skip over any that are of particular interest to you?
I mean, it's, you know, it's such a big term by the time we're done. You know, I think the only thing I would add is, I think it's really also helpful. I mean, you were kind enough, Bob, to mention at the top my op-ed, and the op-ed, you know, derives from this longer essay I wrote last year for the Harvard Law Review. I think it is very easy for folks who don't watch the Supreme Court for a living to, you know, sort of show up in June and July when we get these really big decisions and look at like 5 or 6 or 7 cases and, you know, make sort of generalizations about the court based on that handful of cases. And I think the data points are actually almost as important and sometimes more important with what the court does outside of these cases, what the court does with stays, you know, allowing policies to go into effect even when there are serious legal objections to them. The cases it refuses to take up, where, you know, it's denying certiorari even though everyone agrees it's a really important constitutional question that's not settled by the lower courts. And, you know, I think as much as the court has become increasingly part of our political narrative and our political sort of news cycle, I hope we can bring with it some nuance too, that the court does lots of things to shape our lives that go way beyond, you know, what it says in these huge handful of decisions that we spend most of our time talking about. And, you know, that's not necessarily accessible to the public the way that it ought to be. I think that's part of why they do it. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't pay attention. And so, you know, if I have sort of a hobby horse here, it's, you know, trying to help folks see that the court is doing a lot more than just the stuff that makes front page headlines.
Hmm. Well, we really appreciate your time here today, Steve, and all the great insights. And Jim, did you have any other word?
I think the last comment from Steve is important. It's important, I think, in terms of where the court goes after an election and the impact that the president has on who sits on the court, but also how they govern the lower courts. Yep. I think it's really important. And I think that's not something that people pay a lot of attention to. They sort of have this magical view that Steve was describing of the court because we see it active in June.
Hopefully it's next year we can do this in person.
Yes, I sure.
Yeah, will. No kidding.
I think we're all getting Zoom weary for sure. So again, thank you so much, Steve. And we look forward to talking to you next year, if not sooner.
It's always a pleasure, guys. Just, you know, stay safe out there. You know, wash your hands, wear a mask, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, it's good to talk with you, Steve.
Likewise.
Good work. Keep up the good work.
Thanks everyone. Our guest this evening was Steve Vladek from the UT Law School. We were discussing recent decisions by the United States Supreme Court. And of course, we had our regular guests, Jim Harrington and Michelle Manning Scott was here as well. A quick note from the Community Council at Co-op. We want to know how you're faring through the COVID-19 crisis. If you have questions about community resources, or if you'd just like to share a story about people doing good work, you can leave us a message by emailing covid19@coop.org, or you can call or text 512-710-5353. A member of our community council will get back to you. That's covid19@coop.org. or 512-710-5353 for Co-op's COVID-19 Community Response Line. Well, that's all for this evening. Stay tuned for theme music coming up next. Have a good evening, everyone, and stay safe.